into the thin receiver, Rapp said, "I'll take care of it, sir. But make sure the cavalry is ready. Things could get real ugly in here."
"I will, Mitchell. And please, be careful."
"Always." Rapp replaced the receiver and looked up at Adams. Some weird shit must be happening on the other side, he thought. Ticking through the possibilities of what might have precipitated Stansfield's unusual call, Rapp stopped a short while down the list. No sense in clouding the mind. He had enough to worry about right here. Pointing at the blueprints, Rapp said, "We have to find a way to check this out." Chapter 39. Barely a half hour had passed since Stansfield's edict. Rapp had to remind himself continually to be more cautious as he and Adam searched the blueprints for a way to accomplish the task. Reely had edged her way over from her nest in the corner and now lay on her stomach, her hands under her chin. Every once in a while, her white-stockinged feet would kick up in the air behind her like a little teenager's. She was playing it smart for the moment, saying nothing and listening to everything. She had worked her way back into the group. On at least three occasions, Rapp had run through the different options, none of them all that appealing, and now resigned himself to take the direct route. The route that would most quickly accomplish his task, but also endanger the lives of the remaining hostages. Feeling as if he'd been pent up in a cage since he'd landed at Andrews 2 days ago, it was difficult for him to resist the desire simply to go down to the basement, shoot the guard, shoot this Yassine fellow, and disable the scrambler. If he couldn't find another way, it might be the only solution. But there had to be another way, or the whole thing would end in a bloodbath. Rapp was beginning to resign himself to what he had known when the whole mess had started. Take Aziz, enough Semtex to blow up the whole building twice, and you end up with a bunch of dead hostages. Why even risk the assault team? Just let the idiot blow himself up and end the thing. Milt Adams flipped several sheets over and studied something. Rapp watched him, then asked, "What?" Adams looked at the drawing, and then up at the blank wall. He was trying to visualize something. Looking back down, he said,
"This is the hallway on the third level. It runs down like this and takes a 93-degree turn to the left."
Adams tapped the spot with his thin finger.
"There is a recessed vent here. At least I think there is."
"What do you mean, you think? Isn't it marked?" Adams shook his head.
"No, that's why I'm saying I think there is."
Adams closed his eyes again, forcing himself to try to remember what the hallway looked like.
"I really think there's a vent there." Adams tapped the spot again.
"Why isn't it marked?"
"These aren't the final blueprints. If I remember right, they were worried that there would be too much moisture in the hallway if they didn't have some ventilation. You see, this entire hall was added when they put the bunker in, and the bunker's environmental systems are buried underneath it, so they can't be compromised."
Adams brought his finger up and ran it along his bottom lip.
"I'm pretty sure they sliced into the house's regular system through the floor right above."
Adams pulled one of the sheets back over. It was the layout of the second basement. He searched for the right spot and said,
"This is where they would have done it. They would have just cut in a down chute and brought it in from the second basement."
Adams grabbed the next sheet, showing the first basement, and pulled it over. His eyes darted excitedly back and forth over the drawing.
"This could be perfect."
"What?" asked an impatient Rapp, wishing Adams would explain what good a little vent could do. Adams brought his hands up as if he were a quarterback signaling how far to go for a first down. He slid the two hands forward and placed them on the outside of Rapp's shoulders. Then, with a frown, he said,
"You're too damn big."
Frustrated, Rapp asked, "Milt, what in the hell are you talking about?"
"I'm almost sure this vent is there, but it's only 18 inches wide. Your shoulders are all that plus a couple."
"Back up." With a confused look, Rapp asked, "Where will this vent get us?" Adams flipped back to the drawings of the third basement.
"This vent drops right down at the corner. If you could get to it, you would have a clear shot into the anteroom of the bunker. That's assuming the first door is open.
But you're saying I won't fit.
No. You could lower me down, but...
Adam stopped and rolled his eyes. You'd sneeze and they'd hear it.
Afraid so, Adams nodded.
Rapp swore under his breath. He would have done almost anything to get a look at what was going on in that anteroom. Rapp glanced up from the blueprint and looked at Reilly. She looked like a teeny bopper at a slumber party with her ponytail and sweats. He looked at the rest of her body and was willing to bet that Reilly weighed 105 tops. It took Rapp only a second to decide it was worth it. If she was going to write a story, she might as well earn it. Returning to the scene of the crime couldn't have been a more accurate description. Salim Roussan had found a spot for his ambulance at the end of a line that ran almost a block long. Immediately to his right was the Willard Hotel, the Washington, D.C. landmark that boasted it had served cocktails to the likes of Abraham Lincoln, Mark Twain, Buffalo Bill, and countless others. In the middle of the block was the Willard office building, and next to that, on the corner, was Roussan's former place of employment, the Washington Hotel. Across the street to his left was Pershing Park, named after General Black Jack Pershing, the commander of the American Expeditionary Force in Europe during World War I. The park was lined on two of its four sides with fire trucks. The firemen that were assigned to the trucks lounged about on the green grass of the park, some of them playing catch with a football, others with a bright orange frisbee. A sandwich truck kept the firemen and ambulance drivers filled with coffee, soda pop, and a variety of sandwiches, soups, and microwavable dishes. Four D.C. police squads blocked the intersection barely 30 feet behind Roussan's ambulance at the corner of Pennsylvania and 14th Street. Salim Roussan had returned to within two blocks of the White House. He slouched behind the wheel of the ambulance, a book perched on the bottom half of the steering wheel, and a pair of headphones covering his ears. He was hoping to avoid conversation. A very thin cover story had been crafted, one that would not stand up well after two or three well-pointed questions, especially in an industry where, Roussan assumed, many of the drivers knew each other. Fraternizing with the other paramedics could get hairy, so he would keep to himself. Roussan twisted his wrist and looked at his cheap digital watch. It was approaching 2 in the afternoon. He had been sitting in his spot for almost 3 hours. So far, so good. The other drivers congregated from time to time on the sidewalk or across the street at the sandwich truck. Several of them even played catch with the firemen. As he had thought, they seemed to know each other. The ploy of being immersed in a novel was working thus far, but he couldn't sit in the ambulance forever. There were several things he had to take care of, and that meant taking a walk among the enemy. Roussan checked his side mirror again. The reporters and curious onlookers were milling about like cattle behind a police barricade one block back to the east at the corner of 13th Street and Pennsylvania. Roussan could make out a cop sitting atop his mount eyeing the crowd. If he had time, he would have to try to plant one of the devices near the crowd. The key was to get people running in every direction, toward the White House and away from it. Looking across Pennsylvania Avenue, Roussan admired the shiny red fire trucks lined up one after another. What a wealthy country. Wealthy and selfish. Selfish and greedy. It would be nice to sneak a bomb under one of the trucks and watch the whole row explode one after another. That would cause some serious confusion. But that was out of the question. Too many firemen, too many of them milling about. Someone would see him. Roussan checked his watch again, a nervous habit. The black digital letters hadn't changed since the last time he'd checked, just 40 seconds earlier. It was time to put the book away and get to work. Keeping the headphones on, Roussan stepped through the small passageway into the back of the ambulance. The gurney sat latched to the middle of the floor, and the side compartments were all secured and locked. Using a small key, Roussan unlocked one of the cabinets and pulled out a plastic toolbox. Typically, it would have been filled with medical supplies to treat accident victims, but instead, it was filled with small bombs that had been designed by Aziz. They were ingenious, yet simple. Each bomb consisted of Semtex, a blasting cap, and a pager that acted as both the receiver and the power source. The bombs could be activated either by Roussan or Aziz from within the White House, or, Allah forbid, someone dialing a wrong number and then punching in the wrong code, which the odds were astronomically against. Roussan reached down and with his hand scraped the freshly ground coffee beans to the side. The smell of the coffee would help confuse any canines that the FBI might use to check for bombs. As an extra precaution, Roussan had also rubbed cayenne pepper on the tires and back tailgate before embarking. If one of the pooches got a sniff of the pepper, they would want nothing to do with the truck. Packed in the coffee grounds were six bombs. Two were shaped to be placed under toilet tank lids. Thin sheets, 1 inch thick, with the pager and blasting cap embedded in the clay-like explosive. These two sheets of Semtex were wrapped individually in wax paper. Underneath the two sheets were four cans of Diet Coke. The top of each had been carefully removed, and the cans had been packed with the malleable explosive, pager, and blasting cap. Roussan picked up a black fanny pack that was lying on top of the gurney and carefully slid the two sheets of Semtex into the pack. After zipping it closed, he climbed back into the front seat and sat there for a minute. When he had gathered the nerve, he opened his door and stepped out into the sunlight. He sauntered around the rear of the truck, like a man who did aerobics twice a day, 7 days a week. His tight pants and shirt, white hair, pierced right ear, and tattoos announced to all his sexual orientation. Skipping up the steps of the Willard Hotel, Roussan pushed through the revolving door. When he stepped into the opulent lobby, he noticed two D.C. cops. Roussan smiled at them as he walked across the tile floor. He had scouted everything out. He knew exactly where he was going and where he would place the first four bombs. He continued across the lobby and up a short flight of stairs. The hotel was closed to the public because it was within the three-block perimeter that had been set up around the White House. When he entered the men's room, he quickly checked to make sure he was alone, which he was. Once in the stall he had pre-chosen, Roussan pulled off the ceramic tank cover and laid it upside down on the toilet seat. He wiped the condensation off the lid and then carefully extracted the first bomb from his fanny pack. It fit inside the lid precisely. Roussan had taken photos of the lid to make sure there were no mistakes. Pressing the Semtex into place, Roussan made sure the bomb was affixed to as much of the surface as possible, and then he extracted a roll of duct tape. At each end of the bomb, there were 2 inches of uncovered ceramic. Roussan cut three pieces, laying each one across the Semtex and making sure it was firmly attached to the underside of the cover. When he was done, he put the duct tape back and replaced the lid. Satisfied, Roussan unzipped his pants and began to relieve himself. One down, three to go. Chapter 40. It had taken almost no effort to convince Reilly. Adams actually made several attempts to douse her enthusiasm, but she would have none of it. She was in. Rapp wasn't sure if she wanted to do it out of patriotism, sympathy for the remaining hostages, or professional greed. He hoped it was one of the first two and not the latter. The plan came together in short order. Adams was a natural problem solver with the tedious mind of an engineer. Rapp, with his practical experience, tried to simplify every aspect of the operation, knowing that the more complicated it became, the stronger chance that it would fail. For her part, Reilly listened well and asked pointed questions when needed. Rapp had told them, "This is simple recon, nothing fancy. Just take a look and then get out." He then went on to brief Reilly on how they would proceed, and then, before leaving the stash room, he gave her one more chance to back out. She didn't waver for a second. With everything covered and the clock ticking, Rapp grabbed the proper gear and gave Adams the go-ahead signal. Adam slid back the bolt, and Rapp was the first one into the closet. Having already checked the surveillance units, they knew no one else was currently on the second or third floors. They moved quickly and quietly across the hall and into the small elevator. Reilly was in sweat socks and made no noise. When they arrived in the first basement, the doors slid open and Adams went to work with the snake. Rapp and Adams were working well as a team, but now, with Reilly as the third wheel, it was another variable to worry about. Adams retracted the snake and over his shoulder he whispered, "All clear." Rapp asked, "We go to the right, halfway down the hall?"
"Yep."
"Good," whispered Rapp. "Here's the routine." Rapp looked to Reilly, who was no more than a foot away. "When we open this door, I step out first. I sweep to the left, and then the right. When I give you two the signal to move out, you go. Milt in the lead, you with your right hand on his right shoulder." Rapp was happy to see that her eyes were open wide, a sign that she was paying attention. "You keep that hand on his shoulder, and keep your eyes on the back of his head. If he speeds up, you speed up. If he slows down, you slow down. And if he crouches, you get down. If I have to start shooting, I don't want to worry about you jumping out in front of me." Reilly nodded, and then blinked for the first time in a while. All of a sudden, she didn't think this was such a good idea. Either it was colder down here, or she was getting the chills from fright. Rapp asked her something, and she stared back at him with a blank expression. "Are you nervous?" Reilly nodded, eyes wide open. "Good," Rapp grinned. "You should be." He grabbed her right hand and placed it on Adams's shoulder. "Just follow Milt, and everything will be fine." Rapp cracked the door just an inch at first and looked down the hallway. With nothing in sight, he opened the door another foot and peered in the other direction. With his MP10 leveled in his left hand, he opened the door the rest of the way and stepped out into the hallway. After checking both directions again, his right hand shot up and pointed for Adams and Reilly to move out. Adams started out on cue, his bald head scrunched down between his shoulders as if bullets might start whizzing over his cranium at any moment, the all-important S key in his right hand. Reilly mimicked his posture and scampered behind him on the balls of her stockinged feet. As soon as they were clear, Rapp closed the nondescript door that concealed the elevator and fell in behind them. Within seconds, Adams had stopped at another door and was inserting his key. He fumbled with it for a second, his hands shaking slightly. After one misfire, he stuck the key all the way in and turned the knob. Adams yanked the door open and was immediately pushed inside the room by Reilly, who was being pushed by Rapp. Rapp pulled the door shut and looked around the rectangular-shaped storage room. Reilly was doing the same and whispered, "I thought we were going to the china room."
"No," Adams shook his head. "The china storage room."
He approached one of the many wheeled gray plastic containers that stood about 4 feet tall. Adams pulled off the protective cloth cover and revealed a collection of plates, saucers, and cups.
"These things are spring-loaded."
Adams picked up a china dinner plate.
"When they decide which china they want for an event, they just wheel this whole thing into the kitchen elevator and take it upstairs."
Reilly looked around the room.
"All of these contain sets of china?"
"Yep."
"That's great." Rapp was already moving several of the containers out of his way so he could get to the wall where the vent was located. Adams joined in, and they passed the wheeled containers from one to the other. While they were doing so, Rapp looked at a second door located on the wall to his right and asked, "Is that what I think it is?"
"Yep."
Adams nodded as he looked up for a second.
"Good. I think it's going to come in real handy."
Rapp moved the last container and saw the vent cover on the bottom of the wall. It looked to be about a foot and a half wide and maybe a foot tall. Rapp stepped out of the way and Adams moved in. Dropping down to one knee, he pulled out a small cordless drill and quickly backed out both screws. With his fingers, he pulled the slatted cover off and dropped all the way down to his stomach. With a flashlight in hand, he stuck his arm in first and then half of his head. After bouncing the light off the ductwork for a couple of seconds, he found what he was looking for, the down chute that led to the lower floors and eventually to the HVAC unit in the basement. Adams pulled his head out and looked at Rapp, who was kneeling next to him.
It's right where I thought it was. 10 feet down this way, go straight down 2 floors, and she has to crawl about 12 feet, and there's the vent.
Which way does she go when she hits the 3rd level? Adams jerked his thumb.
She keeps going the same way.
Rapp looked at his watch and said, All right. Then, turning to Reilly, he said, Last chance to back out. Reilly grinned reluctantly and looked at the small opening that Adams was lying next to.
I'm ready.
Rapp looked at her and again wondered what her motivation was. Standing there in the president's oversized West Point sweats, she did not fit the image of the brave and bold. Rapp thought she looked scrawny. He had to hand it to her, though. Whether it was professional motivation, sense of obligation to her fellow hostages, or just good old Catholic guilt, the woman was tough. She'd had the crap kicked out of her, was almost raped, and yet here she was, willing to go right back into the fray. Rapp nodded at her with admiration and said, Give me a couple of minutes, and we'll get you on your way. Rapp took off his fanny pack and laid out the climbing rope and one of the surveillance units.
Is she going to have enough light in there?
Adams thought about it for a second.
Yeah, it spills through the vents about every 10 to 15 feet.
Good. Holding the rope up, Rapp turned to Reilly and said, Go lie down over there by the vent, and we'll tie this around your ankles. Rapp cut a 4-foot section from the end of the rope and tied one end to Reilly's right ankle and the other to her left. When he was satisfied with the knots, he tied the rope to the middle of the 4-foot section. This allowed Reilly to move her legs independently, which would have been impossible if her ankles were tied together. After asking her how the knots felt, Rapp asked, Any questions before we get started? Reilly looked up from her position on the floor.
Yeah. How in the hell do I signal for you guys to pull me back up?
Rapp frowned. That's a good question.
How about if you tug 3 times on the rope?
How?
Reilly craned her neck backward and looked into the duct.
There isn't enough room for me to do that.
Yeah, I suppose you're right.
Looking to Adams, Rapp asked, Any ideas? Adams thought about it for a second, his lips scrunched up. Finally he said,
Yeah, I got one.
Adams then sat and began taking his boots off. He took out the left bootlace, then the right, then tied them together. He tied one end to the long rope, and the other one he loosely knotted around Reilly's neck.
When you want us to take you back up, tug on this 3 times.
Reilly nodded, and Rapp said, Good thinking, Milt. Then looking down at Reilly, he said, Down this way about 10 feet, and then straight down until you hit the bottom. Now remember, when you reach the 3rd level, you're going to need to turn yourself around 180 degrees so you can bend at the waist. Then, once you get back into the lateral duct, you can spin back onto your stomach. Rapp mimicked the maneuver with his hand. From there, you crawl down to the 1st grate, and that's where you should have a view into the room just outside the bunker. Don't hang around long. This should take no more than a minute. Note how many people you see, if any, and what type of equipment. Then tug on the shoestring, and we'll pull you right back up. Reilly nodded, her face tense with nervousness. And don't forget to flip back over on your back so you can make the turn when we're pulling you back up.
All right. Let's get going before I change my mind.
Reilly rolled over onto her stomach and started squeezing into the vent.
3 tugs.
That was it. And then she wiggled her thin body into the air duct. It was cramped and dusty. Reilly doubted that Rapp could have fit in the duct, and if he could have, there wouldn't have been any room left for him to maneuver. It didn't take long to reach the shaft. As Rapp had said, it was maybe 10 feet. Reilly paused at the top, only her fingertips and chin hanging over the bottom. There was just enough light for her to see the bottom. It wasn't as far as she had expected. Slowly she started down, her arms first, her head, then her whole upper body. After that, the rope became tight, and Rapp and Adams began to lower her. Riley remembered what Rapp had said, and when she neared the bottom, she spun herself around so she could bend at the waist and make the turn. She pulled herself into the lateral duct and rested for a second. The knots felt a little tight on her ankles, but were bearable. After gathering herself, she spun back onto her stomach, and that was when she heard it. A whining noise. The sound of machinery working. The sound of a drill. Riley's heart rate quickened. The first vent was just ahead on her right. From where she was positioned, she felt as though she could almost reach out and touch it. With some reservation, she inched forward several feet and stopped. The noise had not gone away. As slowly as she could, Riley scooted forward an inch at a time, using all of her concentration to make sure no noise was made. The duct became brighter with the light from the hallway. As she neared the grate, she grew nervous at how well she could see her hands. Approaching the vent, she could start to see the off-white wall of the hallway. The cover had a series of vertical slats that were angled to force the air down. Riley laid her head flat so she could try to get a look straight down the hallway and into the bunker. What she saw caused her to hold her breath. Straight ahead, just down the hall, was the shiny vault door to the president's bunker, and attached to it were the objects that were making the noise she had been hearing. Drills of some sort. Three of them. One big and two small. Riley moved her head around and tried to get better angles of the anteroom, but could find none. On the floor there appeared to be a variety of toolboxes and some tanks. She could see only part of the room because the first door was not swung all the way open. Riley was finishing her inventory of what little she could see and was preparing to reach for the string around her neck when a man appeared. He came into her view from a part of the room that she could not see. Riley's first reaction was to move back a little out of fear that he might be able to see her. She quickly realized this was stupid and told herself to calm down. The man, who looked more like a plumber than a terrorist, approached the drills with a cup in his hand. He touched the casings of each one with his hand and then went about measuring their progress with a tape measure. Oh, this was going to be one hell of a story, Riley thought to herself. She watched the man for another couple seconds and then tugged on the shoestring three times. After a slight pause, she began sliding back down the vent. Jack Warch had decided on a course of action. He wanted to build a consensus among his agents first and then bring his plan to the president. He didn't want any surprised faces if the president asked them for their opinion. Warch had taken a minute or two with each agent, and all of them had enthusiastically backed their boss's idea. Now came the hard part. President Hayes was sitting next to Valerie Jones on one of the couches playing a game of gin. Before walking over, Warch checked the door one more time. All indications were that they were running out of time. Walking across the carpeting, Warch stopped just on the other side of one of the longer couches and cleared his throat. When the president looked up, he said,
"Excuse me, sir. Do you have a second?"
The president looked back at the discard pile and said, "Sure." Hayes closed his hand up and set it face down on the table. "Excuse me, Val." After getting up, he walked around the couches and joined Warch, who had walked over to the corner by the bathroom. "What is it, Jack?"
"Sir, I want you to hear me out before you say anything."
Warch gave his boss a stern look that told him he was very serious. Hayes nodded, and Warch continued.
"I have an idea, one that I think will work, but it's going to take some balls on our part and a little bit of risk."
"Okay, let's hear it."
"I want to start out by saying that just sitting here is not a good option. Every one of my agents is willing to sacrifice his life for you, so I want you to stop thinking about us. We volunteered for this duty, and we all knew what the risks were when we signed."
Hayes started to shake his head. "I'm not going to change my mind, Jack. There's been enough bloodshed." When that door opens, we are going to surrender peacefully and take our chances.
Warch snapped at the president.
Let me finish.
Hayes backed up a half a step in surprise and nodded his consent for the special agent to continue. Warch composed himself and started again.
We, he said, pointing to himself, are not what is at issue here. You are what is at issue. And not just you as a person, but you as the president. In the big picture, all of our lives, Warch pointed to the other agents in the room, don't add up to one president. The president must be protected at all costs. That's my first point.
Warch held up his forefinger.
My second point is that just laying our weapons down and surrendering doesn't guarantee us anything. Who's to say they won't line us up and shoot every single one of us, including you?
The president thought about it for a moment, and then said, There are no guarantees, Jack, but I don't see any other alternative.
I have one. It's a little daring, but it's a heck of a lot better than sitting around and waiting for them to open the door.
What is it?
It's something they'll never expect. We have 9 highly trained agents in this room. 3 of them have served on the counter-assault team and have extensive training in hostage situations. My proposal is...
Warch paused and took a big breath.
That instead of waiting for them to get this door open, we open it ourselves and catch them off guard.
The president frowned.
Hear me out, sir. We have the firepower to get you out of here, and we'll have the element of surprise on our side.
Hayes folded his arms across his chest and thought about it for a moment. Looking at Warch, he said, Tell me more. If we're going to do this, we need a game plan. When they pulled her out of the vent, her black sweatsuit was covered in dust, as was a healthy portion of her ponytail. Reilly flipped over onto her back and sat up. Rapp and Adams were poised just above her, eagerly awaiting the report. Remembering to keep her voice at a whisper, Reilly nodded her head vigorously.
They're doing it. They've made it through that outer door you told me about, and they're working on the big shiny door that leads to the bunker.
With what?
Asked Adams.
I'm not sure, Reilly gestured with her hands. I think they're drills. At least that's what they sounded like. The guy who's down there pulled out a tape measure and held it up to the door.
Adams tried to ask another question, but Rapp stuck his hand out and stopped him.
From the top, he said to Reilly. What did you see?
Reilly took a deep breath and let her hands fall to her lap.
I saw 3 objects attached to the door. Like I said, I think they were drills. On the floor, there were 2 boxes, like toolboxes. One was red, and the other one was gray.
Reilly stopped and tried to remember every detail.
There was 1 man. He walked from the left side of the room where I couldn't see him, because that first door isn't swung all the way open.
Reilly's eyes danced over her story as she pictured it.
The man had a cup in his hand. It was probably coffee. And he walked over to the drills.
Reilly's left hand was cupped, as if she were carrying a mug, and the right was held flat.
He placed his hand on the drills. I think he was checking to see how warm they were.
Adams nodded knowingly.
He's afraid they're gonna burn out on him.
Reilly shrugged.
Well, after he was done doing that, he pulled out a tape measure and held it alongside each drill.
What did he look like? Asked Rapp.
Not like the others.
You didn't see him when you were being held in the mess?
No.
How did he look different?
He was, really searched for the right adjective. Pudgy, and I guess a little older.
How old?
I'd guess late 40s to 50.
Was he armed? This one stumped, really. Her eyes looked to the ceiling while she tried to remember. After a moment, she shook her head and said,
I'm not sure.
Rapp accepted the answer and tried to think if he was missing anything.
Did you see anyone else? Hear anything else? Anything you can think of?
Reilly shook her head.
Nope. I wasn't down there very long.
Rapp reached down and started untying the rope.
Nice work, Anna.
Now, I want you to wait here while I go back upstairs and report in. I think we're going to have some more work to do, but I have to let them know that their hunch was right. Rapp finished untying the rope and stood. Reaching for his gun, he said, Milt, let's go. Adams struggled up from one knee and pointed at his feet.
What do I do about shoelaces?
After looking at Reilly's white-stockinged feet, Rapp said, Take the boots off and go in your socks. We're just going up and right back down. Adams took the boots off, and then moving toward the door with Rapp, he said sheepishly,
Mitch, I have to go pee again.
Rapp looked at him sideways. Something clicked in his head, and he stopped. Turning back to Reilly, he asked, Anna, did you say the guy was drinking coffee? Reilly nodded.
I think so.
Rapp smiled and glanced at Adams. Milt, you're a genius. Chapter 41 Harris and Reivers pulled up to the main gate at Andrews Air Force Base and presented their credentials. They were saluted and waved through quickly. Harris was on a mission to find General Campbell, and the fact that General Flood was reportedly with him was all the better. Might as well hit them both up at the same time. Flood, after all, would have to give his stamp of approval to anything they would want to execute. Reivers maneuvered the heavy Suburban around several turns and gunned the gas-guzzling V8 engine. Harris had told him to step on it. Right now, Delta was getting face time with the generals, and every second counted. SEAL blood had been spilled, and Harris was going to do everything possible to make sure they had a piece of the action. Less than a minute later, Reivers came to an abrupt stop near General Flood's limousine and its two security sedans. Several Pentagon pukes were standing around in their cleanly pressed green uniforms, keeping an eye on the cars. Inside, no doubt, were more of them, waiting to wipe General Flood's nose in case he got a sniffle. Harris and Reivers jumped out of the Suburban, Harris with a file folder, Reivers with a submachine gun. The file folder Harris carried contained a briefback. The briefback was a special forces document that outlined a specific mission that was being proposed down to the last detail. Harris and Reivers moved toward the rear of the hangar, where Harris spotted two of General Flood's staff pukes milling about. Approaching the door, one of the general's aides, a major, put up a hand and attempted to ask Harris his business. Harris, not wearing any rank or insignia, continued right past the officer and opened the door. Reivers followed his boss and closed the door behind him. Inside, standing in front of a chalkboard, were Generals Flood and Campbell. They were both listening to Colonel Gray, Delta Forces commander. Several other Pentagon, JSOC, and Delta intelligence and administrative types were seated at a long table working among themselves. Harris and Reivers approached the front of the room and snapped off salutes to General Flood. After Flood returned the salute, Harris apologized for the interruption.
That's all right. We wanted to talk to you anyway.
Then, gesturing to the blackboard, Flood said,
We were just going over several takedown scenarios. I'd like to hear what you think.
Harris eyed the old blackboard for a second and said,
Billy and his people know their stuff. They don't need me looking over their shoulder.
Harris looked to Colonel Gray and winked. Gray gave his counterpart at SEAL Team 6 an approving nod.
I do have an idea about something else, however. A solution to an obstacle that we need to overcome before we even consider launching something like this.
Harris gestured to a large diagram of the White House compound taped to the right side of the long blackboard.
We know from Iron Man's recon of the mansion that there are explosive devices to be dealt with. He found a bomb in the president's bedroom. Why put a bomb there if you're Aziz?
Harris looked quizzically at the two generals and Colonel Gray.
All of the hostages are over here.
Harris pointed to the diagram, in the West Wing.
The only reason I can think of is to bring the whole building down and add to the chaos surrounding any attempt by us to retake the building.
Flood thought about it and slowly nodded.
I would agree.
Knowing this, we can infer that, like with rats, when we see one, we can assume there are many more.
Pausing for emphasis, Harris let them think about the harsh reality of sending dozens of operators into the building only to see them engulfed in a ball of flames and flying debris.
Before we launch any type of a mission, we need to get someone in there, and they need to find a way to neutralize those bombs.
Colonel Gray nodded emphatically.
This hasn't been lost on us. Right now we're banking on the fact that we can get in and shoot fast enough to stop one of them from hitting the plunger.
Gray didn't look too enthused about his odds.
And if Aziz has the hostages booby-trapped?
Gray shook his head, knowing that this was probably the case.
We're screwed.
Exactly. That's why I think we have to get a small team of operators into the building just prior to the main assault, to assess the situation and find a way to defuse or temporarily disable the bombs. Otherwise, we can kiss our asses goodbye.
The other men thought about the ugly scene, and after a moment, General Campbell spoke.
Let me guess, Dan. You know just the person to handle this delicate aspect of the operation?
Grinning, Harris replied, As a matter of fact, I do, sir.
Let's hear it.
With his voice a touch lower, Harris said, Did any of you ever get wind of a training op we did with the Secret Service 8 years ago? General Flood at the time had been in Korea, and General Campbell had been on a special detachment working with the SAS in Britain. Colonel Gray, however, had been with Delta. Gray searched his memory. They were constantly doing training ops, but off the top of his head, he couldn't remember doing anything with the Secret Service.
You're going to have to refresh my memory, said the CO of Delta Force.
Harris leaned in a little closer.
It was very hush-hush. They wanted the boys at 6 to help them test certain security precautions. And for obvious reasons, they didn't want it publicized, especially after the results.
Before Harris could continue, one of the general's aides approached the group and apologized for the intrusion. Extending a secure digital phone, the captain said,
Director Stansfield is on the line, General.
Flood took the phone in his hand and said,
Thomas?
The general's eyes tightened, and he said nothing. After about 20 seconds, he said simply,
Shit.
After another 10 seconds, he replied,
I agree. I'll catch a chopper back. Get everything set up.
Flood ended the call and handed the phone back to his aide. Then, looking at the man around him, he said,
We just got some really bad news. Iron Man confirmed that they are drilling into the president's bunker.
Shaking his head, he looked to Colonel Gray and said,
Bombs or not, you're going in.
Then, looking to Harris, he said,
I have to get back to Langley immediately. Whatever this idea of yours is, I hope it's good, and I hope you can put it together in a snap.
Harris nodded confidently. My men have been on it since this morning. Rafiq Aziz leaned back in the president's chair. The long, shiny surface of the Situation Room's conference table was laid out before him. Aziz's eyes were closed and his arms folded across his chest. It was the middle of the afternoon and he was trying to get some sleep in anticipation of a long night. In front of him on the table was his MP5. The overhead lights were extinguished, the glow of the bank of muted TVs at the far end throwing a dim light. There was a knock on the door. Aziz's alert eyes snapped open, and he said,
Enter.
The door opened slowly, and Muammar Benghazi stepped into the room.
You asked me to wake you at 3.
Thank you.
A yawn crept up from his throat.
How are the men? They are well.
Are you making sure they get some sleep? This will be their last chance for a long time.
Benghazi approached the conference table and placed his hands on the back of one of the leather chairs.
As you ordered, they are sleeping in 2-man rotations for 2 hours at a time.
Good.
May I sit?
Aziz rubbed his eyes.
Yes.
Benghazi set his AK-74 on the table and sat. Looking guardedly toward his leader, he asked,
What are your thoughts on tomorrow?
Aziz unfolded his arms and checked his watch.
By nightfall, we should have the president in our hands, and then?
Aziz's lips parted and turned upward at the edges.
We will truly have the upper hand.
Will you tell them that we have him tonight, or will you wait until the morning?
I will tell them in the morning.
Aziz gestured to the TVs.
They have been reporting that the UN will meet our demands. Vice President Baxter will keep them at bay until he gets his next batch of hostages tomorrow.
Benghazi was persistently guarded.
You do not think they will come tonight?
Aziz shook his head, feeling so confident in his prediction that he didn't need to give a verbal response.
I wish I shared your optimism, but after what they tried to do this morning, I can't help but think they are preparing to attack.
The comment caused Aziz to smile.
That is why you are so valuable, Muammar. You are so cautious.
They will not do anything until they hear the next round of demands.
Aziz tapped the side of his head with his forefinger.
You need to understand the American mind, especially the mind of the politician. Being decisive is not in their character. They will put off making a decision until they are forced to do so. Right now, they have gained the release of a third of the hostages, and they are playing under the assumption that they can continue to negotiate for the release of more.
Benghazi frowned.
It makes no sense to me. Surely the military is advising to attack.
They probably are, but it makes no difference. As long as the politicians think they can free more hostages without firing a shot, they will do so.
Not when they find out what the next demands are.
Benghazi shook his bald forehead.
There is no way.
When we have our hands on the president, everything will change. Speaking of the president, how is our little thief proceeding?
He says he is still on schedule. Sometime around 7 this evening.
Aziz smiled with anticipation.
It will be a great moment.
Benghazi nodded slowly, not sharing in his leader's complete confidence. After looking down at the table for a while, he said,
I think we should announce that we have the president as soon as we get him out of the bunker.
Why?
It will deter the Americans from attacking.
Shrugging, Aziz placed his hands behind his neck. My plan will not change. When I make my final demand tomorrow, I will need the surprise of having the president standing beside me to shock the world into doing what is right.
Chapter 42. Reilly stretched out on the concrete floor, her legs before her forming a V. First the left leg, hold it for a 20 count, and then the right. The stretching felt good. While she worked out the soreness in her legs and lower back, she thought about her career. Reilly was, after all, an insider. She had pulled back the curtain and had watched and participated in the mighty and powerful Oz's show. The public was not allowed to peer behind that curtain to see how stories were shaped, how careers were made or broken around those one-week periods known as Sweeps Week. The public never saw how producers and executives juiced up stories, exaggerating some details and downplaying or ignoring others, how they went after something or someone not based on how strong or important the story was, but what their ratings books told them. Anna knew her story would be hot. It would be more than hot. It would be incredible. She would have to be cautious. NBC would try to suck the story from her on every possible outlet. The Today Show, Dateline, CNBC, and MSNBC. They owned her. There were no illusions about that. She was on the clock, and her contract left no loopholes for appearing on other network news shows. To keep her happy, they would repay her with exposure, probably allow her to do some stories for Dateline. That was the way the game was played. There would be a book deal, for sure, but she would have to be careful about that. She wanted to write it herself and take her time. No big bucks hire a ghostwriter and have it on the shelves in 2 months deal. The key would be to find the right agent, one who was willing to push for money and more time. The result would be a more authoritative story. She honestly felt that this was a story that needed to be told, but in the right way, dignified, worthy of the seriousness of the situation and of the people who had died. She would work with Mitch Cruz. Reilly smiled pleasantly at the thought of the man who had saved her.
He was all man and then some. Nothing pretty about him. Handsome and rugged. A real man. As to his real identity, the no-brainer answer was that he worked for the CIA. But one could never tell. He could be FBI. They weren't exactly forthright with information either, at least when dealing with journalists. Really could hardly blame them, though. She'd seen her father and his fellow law enforcement brethren get burned countless times by dishonest journalists. Really had vivid memories of her father's scathing criticism of reporters, especially newspaper reporters. Barely a week passed when he wouldn't throw the paper down in disgust and explain to her mother how the reporter had his or her facts all screwed up. Seeing how lax reporting affected her father served as motivation for Really to get things right. That's what she would do with the book. Really smiled as the ideas fell into place. The very thing that would make the story all the more appealing, and at the same time honor Cruz's request, would be to keep him as he was, a very lethal, dark, rugged, and anonymous individual. She would be protecting her source, just like a good reporter, and it would only add to the intrigue of the book. Really heard something on the other side of the door. Her heart leapt into her throat, but before she could scurry for cover, the door opened. Rapp and Adams quickly entered the room. Really placed her right hand on her chest and felt her pounding heart. From her spot on the floor, she said, "You guys scared the hell out of me." Rapp's face was tense. Sticking his hand out to help her up, he said, "Next time we'll be sure to knock." Really ignored the comment and took his hand. Standing, she asked, "What's next?" Rapp didn't speak at first. Instead, he looked over at the room's second door. He was thinking something through. After a short while, he looked Really in the eye. "We're going to try something that might be a little risky, but there's no other alternative." Really looked at the door, not knowing what was behind it. Cruz's intensity sent a shiver up her spine. With a forced confidence, she asked, "What's behind that door?" Dallas King strutted back and forth in front of Baxter's desk. The two had been debating what to do with the new information, that there was a good chance Aziz was in the process of extricating President Hayes from his bunker. In his typical defeatist tone, Baxter had whined that it was over. Everything they had done was for naught. Helicopters would be sent in, the men in black would rappel from ropes, and the bloodbath would ensue. He would forever be remembered as the man who presided over the destruction of the White House and the deaths of dozens of Americans. His presidential ambitions were gone, snuffed out. This would be a disgrace the fragile American ego would want to forget. And Sherman Baxter III in the Oval Office would be a constant reminder of this entire ugly week and this gruesome assault on the American way. King stopped his pacing and started snapping his fingers in front of Baxter. "You're not listening to me. Pay attention."
"Shut up, Dallas. I'm listening to you. I just don't believe you."
The vice president leaned back in his chair and tossed a black pen onto his desk. It hit a leather-bound desk calendar and skidded to a stop in between a photo of Baxter's family vineyard and a photo of his parents. King looked down at his boss, not really hurt by the harsh words, but acting as if he were. King was practicing patience. His boss needed to be both coddled and whipped, depending on the situation. Looking down, the chief of staff pulled back the white cuff of his blue dress shirt and looked at his watch.
"Maybe I'd better leave you alone for a while. You seem like you could use some rest."
King pulled his cuff back over the watch with an aristocratic flair. Baxter pointed to King.
"Don't speak to me with that condescending tone of yours, Dallas."
"Well," King looked down at his fingernails, "my opinion doesn't seem to matter much to you, so I thought it would be best if I left you alone."
Baxter rocked forward.
"Don't give me this crap, Dallas."
King turned to face his boss. Now was the time to dig in and then hit him over the head with both the carrot and the stick.
"Then why do I have to fight you at every turn?"
King put his hands on his hips and looked to his boss for an answer.
Sherman, no one ever said this would be easy, but for Christ's sake, I'm getting sick of your loser attitude.
To himself, he added, if you had my problems, you'd want to crawl under a rock and die. Baxter pulled away, leaning back in his chair. After eyeing his agitated chief of staff for a second, he said,
I don't see what in the hell I should be so positive about.
How about the fact?
King stopped and looked over both of his shoulders, making sure no one was around. Then, leaning over the desk, he whispered,
that maybe a certain person might not make it out of the White House alive.
Nodding his head confidently, he added,
one heartbeat away. Don't ever forget it.
Baxter looked down at his desk for a moment, too embarrassed to let King see the thirst in his eyes. The politician in him told him to say the right thing.
I don't want to become president that way.
I know you don't, but Sherman, it would be your duty.
Baxter chewed on the thought.
We don't know where this thing is going to end up, King continued. That's why we have to stay loose. That's why I need your head in the game.
King studied Baxter to see if he was getting through.
Keep the pressure on the UN, and I'll worry about the rest of it. I have some ideas on how we can handle things if Flood and Stansfield keep leaning on you, but I have to think them through.
King looked out the window while he thought about his plans. It was getting late in the day. Maybe 4 more hours of sunlight, and then it would be dark again. If they could just make it until the morning and get another 1/3 of the hostages released, that would go a long way toward a victory. Then they could turn Flood and Stansfield loose, and hopefully his other problem would then be taken care of. Chapter 43. Rapp pointed to the second door, saying, behind that is a reinforced steel door that leads into a tunnel, the tunnel that was used to evacuate the president when the attack started. It runs from here, down a flight of stairs, under the rose garden, and up into the west wing. Reilly was leaning against one of the wheeled storage containers, and Rapp and Adams were standing. Reilly listened intently to Rapp's plan. Talk of hidden tunnels and the evacuation of the president had her curiosity piqued. At this end, the tunnel goes down a flight of stairs, Rapp gestured with his hand, a quick turn to the left, and then down another short flight, where there's another door. That door, said Rapp, talking very fast now, leads to the room just outside the president's bunker, the room that you could see from your spot at the ventilation duct. Looking up, Reilly asked,
so where does that get us?
We need to reestablish communication with the president. Aziz is using some type of a jammer to block communication with the bunker.
How do you know that?
Out of habit, the reporter was ticking down her notepad of questions. When the raid started, we were in communication with the president via Secret Service radio and cell phone for a short period. That is how we knew he was safe in the bunker. When Milt and I came in through the air intake, our reception got worse the closer we got to the White House. Up on the second floor, the reception is a little better. We're pretty sure that the jamming unit is located as close to the bunker as possible for maximum effect. Reilly took in his words and asked,
so why do we have to risk this just to talk to the president?
This is where it gets tricky, Rapp told himself. He didn't want to lie to her, but at the same time he knew he couldn't tell her what he had figured out, that the reason they were doing this was that the vice president wouldn't order the takedown. Anna, I can't get into that with you right now, maybe later, but trust me that there's a good reason why we need to reestablish contact with the president. Reilly eyed him suspiciously, wondering what he was hiding.
This is one of those things we'll talk about over dinner when you tell me your life story.
Rapp laughed. Yeah, sure. I'll put it at the top of the list. Nice laugh, Reilly thought. He used it as a defense mechanism. Every time he wasn't comfortable with a question or a proposition, he laughed and moved on. Reilly gave him a knowing look as if she could see past the smoke screen.
So I'm going to crawl back down there and wait for that guy to go to the bathroom, and then I'm going to tug on the rope twice,
Reilly held up 2 fingers to make sure,
twice,
and then you're going to run down there and do whatever it is that you do for whatever agency it is that you work for, but can't say you work for.
Rapp's quiet laugh and smile popped up right on schedule. That's about it.